Well, welcome to Mental Health Radio. Take it from us. That's our theme music from Joe Cocker, Respect Yourself. I'm host Sheldon Brown with technician Declan Curran. Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us, is promoting mental healthiness. That's our new promotional line, and the show is brought to you and funded by Ember Wellbeing Trust. And we've had a nice little complimentary thing happening to us. I want to make special mention about Radio Kidnappers, another community radio station, which is based in the Hawke's Bay, which will be broadcasting our mental health radio show, Take It From Us, on its frequency each Saturday at 1 p.m. They'll be airing our show, so if there are listeners from Radio Kidnappers in the Hawke's Bay, welcome to Take It From Us. I always like to read something at the start of our show from Facebook, and I've got a little Facebook saying here. It says, headlined, "It's true, people can change. People can learn, grow and surprise us. But if someone does the same thing over and over again, if they keep hurting, disrespecting or disappointing you, it's time to accept the way things are and ask yourself if you can really live with this. You can't make someone change their pattern if they're not willing already, but you can stop participating in it." So today, Take It From Us is a bit of a mixed bag. We start with a discussion among counselling psychologist Vicky Baird, who used to be a regular contributor to Take It From Us, and our friend, broadcaster and consumer advocate James King, with some contributions from me in there as well. Then we'll go to James King in Hamilton for our new segment on headlines in mental health. And then we'll wrap up the show with some tips, amazing tips actually, on good sleep. So here's our first segment, which is all about tips for fostering friendship. And I think that's a key priority for our mental healthiness. There are five tips, so let's take a listen. And we're talking today to counselling psychologist Vicky Baird about relationships and friendships, which were described as rocket fuel for us all in an article in Canvas magazine, which was headed up Through Thick and Thin. So I gather, Vicky, there are five universal tips for maintaining health relationships, healthy relationships. Would you like to just outline some of those?
Sure. I'll just go through them all briefly and then maybe we can pick out more and talk about them. So the first one is give time. So that means putting more time aside to connect with friends and family. Second one is be present. So obviously it can be tempting when you're with people to be checking your phone or Facebook or, you know, getting distracted by other things in the environment. But this is talking about trying to be fully present and in the moment. So when you're with someone, a friend or a family member, you know, it might be things like switching off your phone or putting it aside and just focusing on being fully there with them. The number three is listen. So actively listen to what others are saying in a non-judgmental way and concentrate on their needs in that moment. Number four is to be listened to. So to honestly share how you're feeling and to allow yourself to be listened and supported by others. And the final one, which I think is a really important one, is being able to recognise unhealthy relationships. So as we mentioned, being around supportive, positive people can help to make us happier, but our well-being can be negatively affected by harmful relationships, which leave us unhappy. So recognising these can help us move forward and actually find solutions to these issues.
We thought we'd start with number five and work backwards, recognising unhealthy relationships, those that may not make us particularly happy. Our well-being can be negatively affected by these harmful relationships. And I guess, Vicky, that, friendships do change over time as well, don't they? And sometimes we, have to make a call about whether friendships are worthwhile or not.
Absolutely, Sheldon, and I'm glad that we're starting with this point because I think it's a core point. The first step is to be able to really recognise what a healthy and unhealthy relationship is. And the problem is, particularly for people who have been through, any kind of childhood adversity, has had maybe unhelpful or dysfunctional relationships in their childhood, and that might be physical abuse or violence, but it could also be emotional abuse or emotional neglect. And particularly people who have gone through emotional neglect in their childhood, those are the people that are really at risk of falling into that kind of grey area of having unhealthy relationships, because often it's more easy to clearly see, for instance, if someone is physically violent, or exceptionally, aggressive and hostile, we can see it. But the more emotional violence, if you like, the subtle things are harder to see. So one of the things we can do if we feel like or we suspect that we're having kind of unhealthy relationships in our life, it's maybe actually just to get a bit mindful. So begin to notice how we feel, what kind of thoughts go through our mind when we're with someone, or particularly just after we've been with someone. So again, it might be getting a journal and noting down, like, okay, what am I feeling? What physical sensations are in my body? What kind of things is my mind telling me, when I'm with this person or just afterwards? And then when we do that, and we can do that with different people in our lives, we start to get a sense of, what kind of relationships might be unhelpful and what might be a bit more helpful. And that can often be the first step.
I mean, I guess when we work in mental health, I find that anything or most things that are discriminatory towards people with lived experience tend to really ring alarm bells with me. And so I guess if people are using those loose terms like nutters, crazies, loonies, psychos, that sort of thing, that can... It has a warning, a warning bell goes off for me, and I guess I become quite selective about whether I'd want to cultivate those people as friends. But, sometimes... we're not in a position to be selective, James. I think in the break you raised an issue of how do we make those first steps towards cultivating friendship.
Well, I think it's about taking a risk, identifying that it is a risk and just doing it anyway. Trying to find places to create relationships can be quite difficult if you've found yourself experiencing depression for an extended period of time and you've become isolated. It's very difficult to make that first step out to meet the world. But you can find people at clubs, at rap classes, in a whole raft of different ways. But you've really just got to take that initial step towards opening yourself up and becoming a bit vulnerable and being open to engaging socially with the world. There was a guy we had on this program early last year, who said he wrote a letter to a person that he might, he wanted to befriend. And that was very successful. He didn't feel confident to meet the person up front. So he just wrote him a little letter and said, yeah, I'd like to, you know, you seem to have things in common with me and vice versa. I'd like to see if we can develop a bit of a friendship. And it happened. So I think if we can show a bit of bravery, there are a lot of nourishing relationships, friendships out there to be had.
Well, I guess one of the places where you have the potential to cultivate those is at Tooewera Live Arts, which is a creative space in Putiki Street.
Yeah, I've got a lot of good friends that I've met through Tooewera. And you're right, these places where you've got a thing in common are great places to start venturing out and developing those friendships.
And Vicky, we talked in February about how these relationships and friendships are crucial, and I think we listed a number of places, include some of the ones that James has mentioned, like the community and rap classes, but also sport and work, and you mentioned online, of course.
Yep, internet forums can be a good place to start, particularly if people don't feel ready to have that face-to-face contact. So the internet has a lot of good support groups and forums that people can get involved in, and that can be a way of starting to, you know, practice those conversation skills in a safe environment, if you like, or a safer environment than face-to-face.
Yeah, and I mentioned too that the meet-up sort of phenomenon, if you like, there are meet-ups for just about everything from Buddhism through to hiking and coffee meet-ups, those sorts of things. Just check out meet-up. There are always groups forming. There are always people with ideas that might be sports-related, hiking-related, food-related, social engagement-related. And so yeah. Meetup is a great place to start. And I met some wonderful people when I was part of the hiking meetup, and that took me to some wonderful places in Auckland that I never knew existed.
Mm. Yeah, that's a fantastic forum. And there's stuff like Meetup for Social Anxiety as well, which is great as well, you know, for those people. Yeah.
So we're moving up these five universal tips for maintaining healthy relationships. James, was there anything further that you wanted to say about making those first steps? I guess it's, you mentioned bravery and courage and that sort of thing. Would you pick up the phone?
Yeah, I think you'd pick up the phone. I think if anybody wants a relationship, they do have to take that first step, and rather than be passive and sit there and wait for it to trot along, because it may never trot along if you're passive about it. I think also within relationships, it takes time to develop trust. So, you know, I noticed in the article you read out earlier on, the risk of being misunderstood or judged in relationships is a real fear, is a real issue. And so long as you can develop a sense of mutual respect, then the comfort you should feel in divulging stuff about yourself should actually get better. Mm. And I know in my own relationship there are things I would never have revealed to my partner when we were first going out, because it was just too deep or too dark or too much. But now we've developed that friendship, now we've developed that relationship further 4 years down the track, we can go to those places. So it's about time and nurturing each other and showing each other that you can actually be trusted with whatever's being said.
Well, I guess that involves respect for the other person, that you don't want to sort of have a bit of shock treatment with them and reveal all in the first date.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. One of the important things I think in mental health particularly is listening, Vicky, and unfortunately there are a lot of people who are professionals or caring, supportive, working in caring and supportive roles who don't seem to be particularly well skilled at listening in mental health.
Yeah, it's a skill that we could do with a bit of training with. They should probably teach it at schools, to be honest. Yeah, but I guess the critical thing about listening, when we're talking about being able to actively listen to someone, some of the main components of that is, one, that we're trying to hold our judgments, like withhold our judgments. So yeah, we'll, you know, as someone's talking, we might have a lot of things going through our mind. We might have beliefs, certain beliefs or judgments about that person or the situation, but just being able to hold that and just really fully hear what the person is saying. And when we're talking about listening to someone, we're not just talking about listening to the words and the content of what they're saying, but the whole person themselves, you know, picking up on their body language, you know, how they're feeling, and also that ability to be able to really put yourself in their shoes. So whatever they're saying to you, you know, really thinking like, what is this person really trying to communicate to me? You know, what is it they're actually feeling? What is it they're thinking? Or what is it they're needing? And really, you know, really fully putting yourself in that position. Because what we often do is, when we get into conversation, we spend more time, while the other person is talking, we spend more time composing what we're going to say or connecting whatever they are saying to something that's happened to us. You know, we can be quite self-focused. So it's getting out of that.
There are two great difficulties too in some relationships, is you've got, on the one hand, someone who talks too much and listens too little. And then on the other side of the equation, you've got someone who says very little and perhaps isn't listening at all. And it's trying to strike that balance, I think, to ask questions of the other person in terms of being a good listener, asking questions of that person, relating your own story that's relevant to what's being said is good, and being just interested and engaged in what people around you are saying in those relationships.
That's a real good point, James.
And I guess, James, in the case of somebody, if you're in the presence of somebody who's not saying very much, is using those open-ended questions, the how, what, where, why, when, rather than the closed questions, which don't encourage the other person to contribute very much in terms of conversation.
Now, that's the journalist coming out, and yeah, but yes, absolutely. It's those open-ended questions that require you to dig deeper and you know, share more about yourself.
Yep, that's it. And I think, actually, going back to a point you made, James, about how some people talk more or some people are more quiet, I think it's being mindful of where do you, as an individual, gravitate. Because I know also, when sometimes one of the defences against being known is by becoming a good listener. And I know that was my experience. You know, I became a really, what I call myself as a good listener. I say that in inverted commas because, you know, by far I've got a long way to go. But I became a good listener in my environment to protect myself from being seen by others. And I think that's what a lot of people do, you know, to stay invisible, to stay isolated. We don't put ourselves out there.
But that's a technique that doesn't do much for our mental health, because I was like that during my married life, married to somebody who was a great talker and very articulate and intelligent and that sort of thing. No space left for me. And, you know, my mental health deteriorated greatly because I lost confidence in being able to actually express myself.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
and so I think that's the danger of adopting the tactic that you've just outlined to us, Vicky.
That's it. So it's so important to be mindful. And I think this is why this article actually highlights the two points of being able to listen to the other, but also being able to be listened to. I think that's why those 2 points are highlighted.
Well, at my philosophy class, in terms of listening and speaking, apparently when we're speaking, we can speak at 250 words a minute, I think it is. But when we're listening, we can take in sort of 450 words a minute. So we've got this added capacity, which we fill with thoughts about, well, while this person's listening to me, I'm working out how I'm going to get home, or how I'm going to get to tennis, or how I'm going to, what I'm going to buy at the supermarket. And, you know, I use the word respect again, James. We're not being respectful of the person who is talking to us if we're not listening.
That's right. From the point of view also of someone who, I've got a friend who recognises that he rambles and that he talks a lot. But when he does throw over to you to have your say on something, he'll interrupt and almost finish your sentence for you.
Mm.
It may or may not be the right finishing, but that's what he does. And I think a certain amount of acceptance is required in dealing with a person like that. But I think it's okay too to say, hang on, just, you know, it's my turn to have my say. And I think that's important to stick up for yourself in a relationship as well, if you feel as though you're being sort of pushed to the margins.
Yeah, that's a really good point, James. I think having healthy boundaries in relationships and also being able to have your voice and be able to say, hey, you know, actually this is not quite working for me. Can we try doing it, you know, in a different way? Or actually, can you just, you know, I really need to be heard right now, you know. So having those kind of skills and you know, they're quite big skills to develop, because it's quite scary, you know, to, for instance, a new example, when someone's talking at 100 miles an hour, you know, it's natural to kind of let them go or to feel bad about injecting in or kind of stopping or pausing. But sometimes we need to have that courage to do that, because otherwise we don't really get involved in a real relationship with that person anyway.
Fear in relationships is such a big issue, I think, in modern society. I had a partner, my ex-partner, in the first year of our relationship, would say sorry almost constantly for things that you wonder what she was saying sorry for. That she wouldn't pipe up and have an opinion, she'd defer to me. And that was because she was fearful of my reaction if she took centre stage, because she'd been in relationships and had relationships in the family where if you were to say something out of turn, that would be met with overwhelming and unconscionable attack. So to, you know, I don't go through life thinking I'm scary, and yet sometimes people do have, you know, I'm a big guy and, you know, I used to have a bad temper. I don't think I so much anymore. But, you know, people, those relationship building things are so fraught with difficulty at times. But that's why I like what you said about, and you, Sheldon, said about, you know, using technology to get into relationships is really good.
But the example that you gave, James, where somebody finishes the sentence for you, makes an assumption, and in fact, what he says or she says is actually completely away from how you wanted to finish
the point
that you were making. I mean, that just leads to so much confusion about the value of this conversation, because it can be taken down blind alleys and dark alleys just through somebody making an assumption which is completely wrong. And so then that has to be corrected. And, you know, so I think it is totally disrespectful to finish somebody else's sentence for them and assume what they were going to say.
I think there are just some people in the world who have so much they want to say, it bubbles out of them. And they're thinking, they're formulating whilst you're talking, they're formulating in their own head what your point's going to be and then jump in and finish it off for them. And that often, I'm thinking of another friend, has often got him into trouble with people.
I think I know one of the people you're talking about, James, and we were exposed to him at a certain cafe where he just completely bowled in and took over, and without any consideration of the fact that we were reviewing the past radio show. But, yeah, I mean, one of the things is we have two ears and one mouth. Use them in that proportion, which might be a fairly good point. Well, we better keep moving through these. Are there any other points you want to make about listening, Vicky?
I think, and I guess it falls on to the next point of being present, but just the importance of being present and being mindful and being aware of our own patterns in relationships, you know, because often we're not aware of what we do in relationships. We're not aware. Some people are not aware that they talk so much. You know, some people are not aware that they kind of shut down, or they might be a bit kind of critical to people. So, you know, that coming back to, I guess, cultivating that self-awareness is so important, and that's something that mindfulness practice can help us with.
Well, I think listening is also damn good for our brain matter, actually, because it trains us to focus, be present, concentrate on what the people are saying, and that's got to be good training for our brain.
Definitely.
I think, in fact, listening has the benefit of sharpening us up. And, well, I guess I have to listen to what my guests are saying, what our guests are saying, and in order to ask, I hope, logical questions at the end of what they actually have said, and hopefully not ask a question which relates to what they've just said, you know, which would be a bit embarrassing. So, I mean, I think it's good for our brain power.
Definitely. It's a mindfulness practice in itself, isn't it?
Well, and it's being in the present rather than while somebody's talking with us, as I say, thinking about what I've got to buy at the supermarket in 25 minutes. So being present, I guess it is related to our listening, but also being present, Vicky, is very close to mindfulness and just generally living in the now.
Definitely. Just kind of focusing on that, you know, that one person in front of you, you know, that one conversation, rather than, say, texting on our phones at the same time, or, you know, making notes or being distracted. So it's being present is really just focusing on this one person in front of you in this relationship.
What would you say to somebody, because this actually happened to me a couple of Sunday afternoons ago when I was having a coffee and late lunch with a friend of mine, and I was chatting away. I must have been as boring as one thing, because suddenly he was on his phone. What would you say to that person?
You put me on the spot there, Sheldon. It really depends. It depends on the relationship you have with that person. I think that's the key, because actually there's a whole host of things you might choose to say or not say, but each relationship is unique. And, you know, one of the basic things we get taught in when we're training to be psychologists or counsellors is the importance of building the rapport, building the relationship, because you can't just go in there and say, hey, look, I wonder what you're doing on your phone right now, you know, if you don't have that kind of relationship. And the more you cultivate a trusting, I think James talked about, you know, having trust, building trust in the relationship. So the more you can do that, I think it's much more easy to have the wisdom to find the right thing to say or do. You know, it might just be like, oh, you know, do you want to, you know, answer that message there? Right. I notice you're on your phone. Did you want to take a break from our conversation and answer that message or make a phone call? You know, that can be a nice non-confronting way of drawing the person's attention to it, you know.
I think that's a lovely suggestion, actually, and very caring. What would you say, James?
I think I'd probably just ignore it and be hurt. Look, I'm so entertaining and interesting that people never do that to me.
That's a healthy defence mechanism.
I'm so engaging. It's incredible.
But
obviously, well, you're saying quite the opposite about my skills and conversation.
That's a great point to highlight. I know we're going to finish up, but, you know, so many people do that, though. So many people ignore things that happen in relationships, but take that hurt away. Mm. And then that's when it can boil and fester over, you know. So I think that highlights a really important point of how important it is to have courage and compassion and to cultivate healthy relationships where we can actually be open and talk about that stuff.
I think if you want to avoid having a relationship collision, then turn your cell phone off while you're with a person.
That's the easiest solution, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's probably the most respectful. But I'd like to repeat what Vicky said, and her suggestion was, well, do you want to take a break in the conversation to take a call or to take a text, and maybe there's something really urgent that you need to address? Mm. And I think that's a very caring and compassionate way and non-threatening. And, you know, I very much like that. So we need to give time, which is the fifth in our universal tips for maintaining healthy relationships. We talked in our previous broadcast about friendships and relationships, of investing in them. And I guess the time that we spend with friends is definitely investing in them, isn't it?
Mm, definitely. You know, I think we should see giving time to friendships or relationships the same as giving time to our work, you know, or sleeping or eating, you know. And even if we have a diary and we mark that space down, you know, so each day we have a bit of time investing in that relationships, yeah.
So sometimes when I'm doing my business mentoring, I say, well, spend 30 minutes trying to develop your business. We need to at least spend 30 minutes of our day maybe cultivating friendships. Good idea, James?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think you can have too many friends either. You always end up with having one or two who are really close, but having a wide social network is all the better for positive living.
Yeah, and I think the nature of those friendships are different, aren't they? Mm. Some of my tennis friendships are just to get out and do a bit of sweating together on the tennis court and having a couple of beers and keeping it pretty light and, you know, laid back. And others are going to fulfill our desire to perhaps talk about more serious issues in society.
That's a great point to finish on, Sheldon. You know, I think it's about recognising what different friendships or relationships serve for us. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's really important.
So there was an interview there between counselling psychologist Vicky Baird and broadcaster and consumer advocate James King, with some contribution from me, and listening to it, perhaps too many contributions from me, and perhaps I wasn't listening quite as much as I should have been. Those tips for fostering friendship, which is a key priority for our mental healthiness, were to give time, be present, to listen, concentrate on the needs of our friend or the person we're talking to, but also allow others to listen, so that we cultivate our own ability to express ourselves, and having some bravery around our relationships and investing time, obviously, in those relationships. So let's go to a music break, and then we'll be talking to James King about headlines in mental health.
I gave you a heads up in advance on this one. It's a guy by the name of Ben E. King. I'd never heard of him before, but he plays the theme tune movie Stand By Me. So here he is, and you're with Take It From Us, Mental Health Radio. We broadcast to you every single Tuesday from, 8:30 then, 12:30 to 1:30 on Planet Audio, Planet FM 104.6.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid just as long as you stand, stand by me. So darling, stand by me. If the sky that we look upon should tumble and fall, or the mountain should crumble to the sea, I won't cry, I won't cry, no, I won't shed a tear, just as long as you stand, stand by me. And darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand now. Stand by me. Stand by me.
Stand By Me from Ben E. King, coming from the movie Stand By Me. Damn good movie if you haven't seen it. Go and check it out.
Well, it might be also another tip that we could add to our tips on friendship and fostering friendship. It's really great if our friends can stand by us and we can stand by them as well, which I think strengthens the bond all up. Well, we've got a new feature on Take It From Us called Headlines in Mental Health. I'm host of the show, Sheldon Brown, with Declan Curran, our technician, and we're going to James King, a broadcaster, a consumer advocate, and a man who understands the headlines in mental health. What have you got for us today, James?
Well, yes. And g'day, boys. I thought I might pick on one aspect of mental health news that's come out just recently, and that's the Helen Clark Foundation coming out in support of what's called a UBI, which is a universal basic income, to help mitigate against emotional, social, and existential depression, or isolation rather, and loneliness. There's studies and research done that that indicate that if people have a livable baseline income, that makes them more susceptible to better health, makes them susceptible to better social standing in the community. And this is something that's come out of Europe, I think. But the Opportunities Party says $13,000 for adults and $20,000 for adults with kids. So it's quite a substantial amount of money that we're talking about here.
That's an increase, James, is it, over and above what they're currently earning?
I don't know if it's over and above, but it could well be, because it would be a universal payment whether you worked or not. That's something that the Helen Clark Foundation is pushing. Why she didn't raise it when she was Prime Minister, I don't know.
So I have been doing a little bit of research into loneliness, because it's something that we're going to cover in a future broadcast of Take It From Us. But yes. Poverty is clearly something that leads to loneliness, because people just don't have the money to be able to get out, maybe spend on friends, go to events and all of that sort of thing.
Absolutely, Sheldon. It's bottom line money. Money in the pockets. You know, if you want to belong to something like a cricket club or a tennis club or a some sort of other social group, there really isn't any help for you to be able to do that, which brings me to the idea of a social prescription, where that allows GPs, nurses and primary care professionals to refer people to a range of local non-clinical services, such as in our context, in New Zealand's context, Toyota and Clubhouse, which have for years been dealing with people in a holistic way, not just a medicalised way.
So this is different to the green prescription that we've spoken about on this program.
Yeah, the green prescription relates to your physical health and provides subsidies for your physical health, but don't really address your social health. For people who aren't particularly sporty, who might be disabled, who might not meet the criteria for a green prescription, this is an excellent other or alternative solution to dealing with mental illness.
So,
it's got to be better than shelling out hundreds of millions of dollars on drugs. I know the government soon announced a $1.9 billion injection for mental health over the next 5 years, but it's where that money is targeted that is the key issue.
So your focus in terms of this headline on mental health, our new sort of segment on Take It From Us. What's the main message, James?
Well, the main message is there are probably more than two, but in the first instance, there are two ways of tackling mental health issues. That's firstly introducing a universal basic income, and there seems to be some evidence around the place that says that a universal basic income does work and does provide opportunities for people, that people are more likely to go out and work if they've got a base income to rely on. And with the social prescription, I think it needs to be long-term. There needs to be a subsidy on going to places like Toyota or Clubhouse, or down here we have to pay for our own materials and what have you down here in Hamilton.
Creative materials and art supplies and that sort of thing.
Yes, that's right, yeah. And it's great that the government's looking at forking out $455 million on frontline mental health services and $40 million on suicide prevention. But where is the social dynamic? Where is the government standing up and saying, we understand that money in your pockets might be a bit light at the moment, but we're coming to the rescue? Where is the government saying social prescriptions are the way to go? It seems to me as though we're lagging behind, certainly Europe, which is more advanced than we are on the social prescription aspect of things.
So just to clarify, James, this social prescription has been put forward in a report, a very lengthy report about loneliness in New Zealand, which was funded by the Helen Clark Foundation.
Yes, yes. And they're just backing up what another organisation is saying about this, basically the same thing, the need to transform our thinking and approach to mental health and addiction services. Incidentally, the report you refer to had 44 recommendations. Now, according to the news the other day, 38 of them were picked up by the government. Well, in actual fact, I read through the report, and the government has only accepted 21 of the 44 recommendations, leaving 7 that they have 17 that have been put on hold. 2 they didn't accept outright, and 4 recommendations they say was up for discussion. So, you know, we're looking at a little under half the recommendations from this report being adopted by government.
So that, having to clarify things here a little bit, that is the major report on mental health and addictions, which encouraged the government to spend this enormous amount on mental health and addictions over the next 5 years.
That's right. There's actually a little comment on the social prescriptions in that report, which is, I think, an oversight.
Right. But the idea initially of social prescriptions came in this report on loneliness, which was funded by the Helen Clark Foundation. And it's something that I want to talk about on Take It From Us, loneliness. I think it's a very complex issue. But have you read that report, which was funded by the Helen Clark Foundation?
I've read bits of it. Yeah. But you're quite right. The report was pretty comprehensive, and as I say, there were two reports: one by the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission, and the other from, as you say, from Helen Clark Foundation.
It's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, I think, James, as to what comes first. Does our mental health determine that we might be lonely because we haven't got the confidence to go out, or does our loneliness cause our mental health?
Well, I think it's a combination of the two, but if people are feeling isolated, they've got to find or should find the courage somewhere along the lines of being able to step back into a life around people, because we are social creatures. Some of us are shy and what have you, but we are social creatures, so we need to keep maintaining our influence in people's lives, and that'll make us feel better in the long run.
Yeah.
I'm just not sure that 425,000 people on antidepressants is a good thing.
Right. So, I mean, you've made a shift from Auckland City down to Hamilton. You've got, I think, extended family, larger numbers of family in Hamilton. But how do you feel, how successful do you feel you've been in moving?
Well, I think, I belong to the Amateur Dramatic Society down here. I'm getting out and walking. I'm painting, which is engaging with other people as well. I'm engaging with family. And that means making time to see each other, sending positive texts, touching base on a regular basis, calling friends, helping friends celebrate events, listening, engaging in conversation. All of those sorts of things coalesce to make positive, long-lasting, and I think healthy relationships.
I think the good thing about that too, just jumping in, is that, once you've got a variety of things like that that you're doing in your day, I think it takes you out of your own self-focus and puts you into an area where, before you know it, time's flying through the day and you can get to that end of that day. And they say it's sometimes a good idea to ask yourself at the end of the day what were the three most positive things that came out of your day. And I'm sure if we scratch around, we can certainly probably come up with four or five.
Well, that's about being grateful, isn't it?
Yeah,
thinking about those three good things that we have in the day, or even remind ourselves of those three good things at the start of the day.
And don't beat yourself up if you set yourself a target to do for the day. I have a priority system. Anything that's an appointment's a P1. Two, you preferably want to get it done for the day. But it doesn't matter. And three is more or less, if I get to it in 2 days' time. And I think by putting that down, listing what you want to do and prioritising it can also de-stress a lot.
Yeah, very good. Very good suggestion. I think we'd better leave you there, James. It sounds as though you're coping with a cold.
Yes, it is. Yes, thanks, guys.
Yes, I thought so too. I'm glad to hear it's not coronavirus, though.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
All right, we'll catch you later.
Take care of yourself.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Okay, well, let's go to a music break. And Declan, what have you got for us now?
I just cut you off before accidentally. I pushed the wrong microphone button, but that's okay. Do you remember the Golden Girls?
Yep.
Oh, good program, that. My favourite was Sophia, the old girl. Thank you for being a friend from Andrew Gold. It's the theme track to that.
And well, it ties in very well with what we've been talking about, fostering friendships and... Yeah.
Travel down a road and back again. Your heart is true, you're a pal and a confidant. I'm not
ashamed to say. I hope it always will stay this way. My hat is off, won't you stand up and take a bow?
Well, a wonderful track. Thank you for being a friend. And I just wonder, actually, a thought that I had is I wonder how often we say that to our friends. Well, thank you for being a friend. It would be, I think, a lovely way of just recognising how important and valuable friends are and how wonderful they are to have around. And one of the other things which can contribute so much to our mental healthiness is sleep. I've got a little paper here in front of me which says nearly everyone has difficulty getting to sleep from time to time. But for some people, this can be a regular, ongoing problem. When this happens, not only do you feel tired, but it can really interfere with your day-to-day functioning and affect your health. And I'd venture to say, too, that it might also impact your confidence to ring people and stay in touch with friends and invest in social contact. So learning how to manage sleep problems can greatly improve the quality of your life. So the question is, what can I do to improve my sleep? It says if you are experiencing the effects of poor sleep, making a few changes to your daily routine and habits can make a big difference. Try these strategies to help you sleep better at night.
Oh, that's my intro. What can you do to improve sleep? Well, you've got that's all right. I got distracted. Set your body clock. Yep. Go to bed and get up at the same time each day, including the weekends.
Wind down at bedtime. Have an hour of quiet time before bed. Switch off your electronic device, particularly your mobile, your tablet, and read. Even have a bath or listen to some music.
And avoid stimulants within 2 to 3 hours of bedtime. Don't smoke, drink alcohol or caffeinated drinks. Eat a heavy meal or do energetic exercise. That's quite good. That I always have. Try to head to bed about midnight, and I usually have 10 o'clock as a shut off
right.
for drinkies.
Yeah, well, midnight might be quite a lot later than most people would necessarily go to bed, but
I get up in the morning at 8:45. You see?
Yeah, well, that's right. So it says make your bedroom suitable for sleep. Keep it cool, dark, and quiet. And I would add to that also to make sure that you have a window open so you get fresh air, and use it says only for sleep and sex,
and reduce blue light exposure in the evening. It disrupts your body clock. I find, you know, since I've had the bipolar diagnosis and all the other medications, I wonder whether that's what causes the grief for me getting to sleep, because I have to have sleeping tablet.
Yeah, well, I wish we had time to talk about sleeping tablets.
That's all right. We can do that another time. You've got community notices now.
That's right.
Take it from us, community notice board.
So there's a book about people who have been through depression and anxiety. It's called How We Got Happy. It's a book by Jonathan Nabbs and Eve McFarlane. This is being sponsored and promoted by the Mental Health Foundation, and I think the Mental Health Foundation is going to benefit 100% from proceeds. The title of this, as I say, is How We Got Happy. It shares the stories of 20 young Kiwis and their diverse experiences of recovery. The book is proof that the journey is different for everyone and provides hope for anyone. You can check that out on Mental Health Foundation's website, mentalhealth@.org.nz. We've also been promoting the wellness classes which are being run by Changing Minds, and Tammy Allen, the CEO of Changing Minds, said if people are looking for some free ways to improve their well-being from the comfort of their own home, these sessions are all free till the end of October. Everything from art and poetry to yoga and fitness. So you can access those. You do need to have access to Zoom, but you can access those at wellbeingsessions.nz.
Just about out of here, aren't we?
Well, it sounds like it, Declan. So they are our two notices. But the issue about sleeping tablets is very much that they are... they can encourage sleep, but people can very much become dependent on them. So, and there could be increased risk of falls, confusion, dementia, and difficulties with driving. So that's a bit of a warning about sleeping tablets.
Good thing for us to come back to on a later show, eh?
Absolutely.
Have a good one. Stay warm and dry. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening.